Thanks, Jim. Thanks for your service today, and thanks for everyone for being here. This is a very exciting day because somebody who I admire the most in my recovery community has agreed to come speak to us today. He's a recovering alcoholic with long-term sobriety, but he's also a very respected therapist at a center called Seeking Integrity. And specializes in something I've mentioned before called chemsex, which is fused substance use with sexual acting out. He's a respected speaker. He speaks internationally, all through the United States, Canada, Europe. And he's also an author, and David is way too modest, so I will do the shameless plug. Lust, Men, and Meth is the book. I read it about a year ago, and I'm fortunate enough to have an autographed copy. And while it's described as a gay man's guide to sex and recovery, about 70% of it is so applicable to anybody in recovery. And David goes into a lot about sexual templates and how that's formed, neuroplasticity and how that gets fused with drug use. And then the whole part three is restoring your life, the recovery process, healing old wounds, embracing feelings, and seven essential tools for strong recovery. So I certainly got a lot out of it, even as a straight person. I know that the book has just been translated into German, and David is off to Europe for a book signing and some more speaking engagements. So I'm thrilled that he's willing to take some time out of his Saturday to be with us. We talked about kind of how to make the most out of David's time. And that what we came up with was about 10 or 15 minutes of David's personal story of recovery. Then maybe about 30 minutes, just David kind of educating us on what chemsex is. And then we'll open the room up for questions, comments, shares. And Jim has been kind enough to keep the room open so we can go over an hour if necessary. So I think those are all the housekeeping issues. And with that, I will turn it over to somebody I am proud to consider a friend, David Fawcett.
Thank you, Charlie. And thank you, everybody. It's a real privilege to be here. I've heard about this meeting from Charlie for quite a while, so I'm really excited to be here, actually. So, and I appreciate the invitation. So my name is David. I'm an alcoholic. And I have been, just started out with the number, has been in recovery since May 25th, 1979, which is 44 years. And so I got in sober in my 20s. You can do the math. And it's been a quite a journey for me. And I do want to talk just briefly about that journey. I started out as a young closeted gay kid in the Midwest part of the United States, very conservative, from an alcoholic family on both sides. So it's kind of genetically set up. In fact, I had one aunt, my father's sister, who appeared not to have alcoholism, and she died of cirrhosis. She was just very good at hiding it, better than the rest of us. So I was really kind of enculturated in it, and was really suppressed. I had a lot of shame about who I was. And it just really, my drinking, as opposed to the guys I work with today, which is more stimulant use, kind of intensify things, I just wanted to numb. My intention was to just disconnect from feelings and not feel anything. Because when I felt anything, it was really centered around shame and feeling pretty lousy about myself. So when I was able to, after college, I escaped to New York City, thinking just the kind of a geographical cure would help me. And I just got worse in my alcoholism. And for 3 years, I really bottomed out in the city, trying to find myself. And it just really kind of crushed me, actually. And I ended up at home alone, drinking. I worked. That was my denial. I never missed a day of work. That's what I told myself. Of course, I had my head down on the desk for most of the day, but I never missed the day. But I would come home and drink. And so I was a solitary drinker. At the end, a little bit of marijuana here and there. And realizing I had a problem, but all these issues were intervening with me. I tried bargaining with different things. I became a vegan. I got a cat. I filled up my time with a master's degree. But nothing interfered with my drinking until I just finally bottomed out. My brother-in-law and sister were both in AA. So I knew about AA. And I knew it was so good, you know, for you poor people, which is my attitude. But I was in a lot of denial about it. When I finally realized I was out of control, and that happened, by the way, when I was passed out. I lived in I didn't have much money. I was working kind of an hourly rate in New York City and lived in basically a tenement up near Columbia where I was studying. And I woke up one morning and there was water in the hallway. I didn't know what was going on, and walked outside and looked up at the building, and all the windows were broken. There was charred black. You know, we had a fire, a major fire in the building, which I had been passed out through, and, you know, very easily could have died. So that was kind of the biggest wake up call of many. So I started going to meetings, and I was trying to find the right meeting. I had this perception of myself as a sort of high bottom drunk. So I started going to the Upper East Side meetings, kind of the Tony meetings where I thought I might fit in better, could not get sobriety, and ended up going to a meeting near where I lived. And in New York City, by the way, at this time, the mental health, you know, the mental asylums had been indeed institutionalized. So everybody had been released, and all the A meetings in New York City were full of homeless people and mentally ill people. And they were really, it was a colorful meeting, let me put it that way. That's where I got sober. I got sober with those people and those people. And I realized, my God, you know, that's kind of who I was. That's where I was. That's as crazy as I was. And I didn't realize it till really my first anniversary. I kind of looked around and said, I really needed these people. And they were my friends. They were my sober buddies that I still have a couple of contact with, a couple of them to this day. So I got into AA, finally went down to the Greenwich Village meeting, started dealing with being a gay man, and was really brought to life by those guys. I must say my life was saved. I learned I had a lot of internal issues, you know, feeling unworthy, feeling unlovable, feeling like damaged goods, and all that stuff that I think most of us probably carry around deep in our core. And a lot of that had to be redone. And I learned it from those guys. I was kind of loved back to health, if you will. I learned how to surrender to this disease. I learned different coping strategies, how to deal with triggers. I learned the power of connection. And I think more in the research wise, even now we realize that there's that wonderful Johann Hari TED talk, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And that's exactly what I found. I found a place where I belonged. And that was another big missing chunk. So for me, it was a wonderful, I had about 3 years of glorious connection and healing. And then in 1982, if you remember the date, in New York City, 1982, we started, friends of mine went to the hospital and died in about 2 days, and another got sick, and that was this weird kind of pneumonia, and there was this thing hitting the gay community called HIV. It wasn't called that at that point, but it was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and I was in the heart of it, in a community that was high risk. And so over the next couple of years, it really turned very dark. Most of my 4 out of 5 people in my home group died in that time. So my whole support community got kind of wiped out. And I never lost my sobriety, but it was terrible in those days. Back before, there was no treatment, there was no services, there was terror, kind of like there was a little bit of the pandemic where nobody knew quite in the beginning how this is transmitted. And so we were living in fear, and people were getting coming back to, you know, cat scratch with MAC could cause blindness. So you saw these guys who were blind, who were had wasting syndrome. They had dementia. It was a horrible time. And people died. People's families wouldn't claim the bodies. Mortuaries wouldn't process the bodies. You know, it was really a nightmare. And after enough of hospital sitting and funerals and enough kind of bleak death, I kind of escaped with my partner at the time to Florida temporarily, and I'm still in Florida. It just felt better and felt good. And at that point, we just were kind of trying to relocate in any place we could. In 1988, on a whim, we got tested, and we found out we were both positive ourselves. And in 1988, it was still relatively much a death sentence. And so my sobriety kind of got hijacked. I never lost it. But boy, for the next 10 years, next decade, it was just survival mode with brain infections and GI infections and all kinds of anemia from medications that nearly killed me. And just so it was a struggle. And ultimately that led to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1994, which almost did it, but it didn't. And in 95, 96, new medications came out. And suddenly everything changed, and I kind of had survived to this point. And something happened to me, and I talked to my clients about it. There is a thing, and it's research-based, called post-traumatic growth, which doesn't happen to everybody, but it, this thing where if we survive traumas that we go through, sometimes, you know, we can take that and kind of make use of that near miss. And that happened to me. I sort of really was grateful to be alive and really grateful to be able to do something for so much suffering I'd seen. And I went back to school. It was my early 40s at that point, and became a therapist over the next couple of years. So then I opened up a private practice around 1998 or so. And that was my service work and my employment at that point. And my work continued, you know, and my purpose with service was really strong at that point. I was very committed and active in AA meetings in my hometown. And most of the guys in my practice, my caseload, were gay men with addiction issues. And around 1998, when I opened, almost from the beginning, I was getting guys coming in complaining of sexual problems, sexual dysfunction. And with a little history, we found that, yeah, there was sexual dysfunction, but it was mostly related to their use of methamphetamine, which kind of had hijacked their system. And I didn't know much about meth, frankly. I'm a kind of a garden variety alcoholic from that point of view. But so I started looking for research. There was nothing out there. There was literally nothing. And so I was kind of on my own in terms of what to do with these guys. And I kind of cobbled together a protocol over the next 10 years. And ultimately wrote the book that Charlie was kind enough to mention. So let me kind of pivot to the chemsex, if you will, because that really is what kind of took over at that point. So chemsex, the word, as the word describes, is this kind of simultaneous use of drugs and sexual behavior. And it can be any drug and any sexual behavior. So most often these days we see amphetamines with sex and porn, but it can be cannabis, it can be alcohol, it can be other drugs I'll talk about in a minute that go with chemsex. It could even be opioids. So almost whatever, we can kind of attach these things to our sexual behavior. And that can be, by the way, it's all genders, all sexual orientations. So men, women. I think one of the great unfortunate labeling issues has been that chemsex is really thought of as a gay issue, and it's not. Actually, the term chemsex itself, a friend of mine who died last year named David Stewart, who worked at 50 16th Street Clinic in Soho in London, actually coined the term. And he really meant it to be, he worked with gay men as I did, who had really survived the same HIV crisis that I had. So the whole experience, not just of the addiction part, but of this kind of looming shadow of the AIDS crisis over the community, internalized homophobia, kind of shame, all the kind of unique aspects that he wanted to call chemsex. But we use that term today for gay men who mix sex and drugs, but it's certainly gay men do not have the monopoly on that kind of behavior. So the drugs that we see are slightly different. We have methamphetamine as the star of the show, still really, really high powered drug, probably the most powerful drug on earth, really hijacks the brain in a way that nothing else does. In the UK, we see mephedrone also, which is another stimulant. Thank God we don't have this in the United States, but it just kind of adds to the fun. I like to mention mephedrone because the slang name is meow meow, which some of you might have heard, but I just like to say that. GHB is another drug that goes with the gamma hydroxybutyrate, which is a drug that is kind of more of a sedative hypnotic. It's a close cousin of the drug called Rohypnol, which is the date rape drug. And we see that, so guys use it to kind of mellow out the intensity of the meth high. So they try to get this perfect mix of G. G is liquid. And so it's really, really easy to overdose because the difference between a nice high and stopping your respiratory system is very little. And guys do it in, you know, dark bathhouse corners or on the dance floor or whatever. And people drop into what's called the G hole, which is they basically will stop breathing. And actually, and again, in the UK, they have beautiful kind of first aid awareness courses for that, for the gay community of what to do if somebody drops into the G hole Right. And we don't have that awareness here in the States. And a lot of guys, their friends will take them back and put them to bed like you would somebody who's drunk. The problem with G, they'll stop breathing. And a lot of people die from that. And a lot of people are being sexually assaulted, by the way. The Terence Higgins Trust in the UK and Cambridge studied 1 out of 4 people who use GHB have been sexually assaulted. And often and it's even more perverse, live stream and so on. We have a good friend and former client here in the States who that just happened to in Palm Springs. So it still happens. It happens to smart people. And a lot of times it's not reported because of the shame involved. It's just people, there's again, it just ties into that internalized well of shame that guys have. So that's GHB. I mentioned methadone, MDMA, ecstasy is a big popular one. Cocaine, of course, ketamine, which is kind of found a new life as an antidepressant of last resort, which has been kind of a miracle drug to reverse people who are suicidal that don't respond to other medications. But ketamine is used as part of the party arsenal. And then poppers, a lot of gay guys use poppers, amyl and butyl nitrates, which are old cardiac medications, has the name because you could pop off the top, like if you have an angina, similar to nitroglycerin. And so they, what it does is just opens up all your blood vessels and just pops them open. It's a big head rush. A lot of guys use it as part of their sexual drug. So you have all these going on, plus other synthetics, and all these things mix and match in a way that's really quite destructive. So what happens with these drugs? And with meth particularly, and meth, by the way, releases about 1,300 times more dopamine than we would have at baseline just walking around dopamine. Dopamine, by the way, is part of our built-in kind of what they call reward circuitry in the brain, which basically has over thousands of years given human beings little feel-good feelings and preoccupation. I mean, let's do that again for things that are pro-social or things that help us survive, things that help us get our genes into the next generation. So cooperating as a tribe, right? Being able to cooperate and collaborate and laugh and have good food and fall in love. And most of all, the most dopamine we get from anything short of addiction is an orgasm. And that makes sense, right? Because we want to have the orgasm repeats it and we want to be preoccupied, we can do that again. But along comes these drugs that mimic that system. They actually block the same receptors for dopamine in the brain, and they just kind of hijack it. So, you know, cocaine will be about 4 or 5 times that rate of an orgasm. The normal rate, methamphetamine is 13 to 14 times. So it's just this really big dump of dopamine in the system that kind of hijacks nothing. A regular orgasm without the drug is like uninteresting and boring compared to the high, that shiny object. And so very quickly, it kind of rewires people's brains in a way that is really destructive. And when we talk about fusion, and chemsex really is fusion. So people ask me sometimes, well, if these are non-alcoholics or non-addicts, if I have a drink of wine with my wife before we have sex, is that chemsex? No, in my mind, it's not. I'm talking about the kind of the ritualized use of drugs and sex went so much to the point where they become one set of behaviors. And that's exactly what the brain does with chemsex. Because of neuroplasticity in the brain's ability to adapt, these drugs become merged and one becomes the other. And so people will see a sexy person on the street and get a drug craving, or they'll think about a drug and want to have sex right away. The two become like indistinguishable. And the big kind of tragedy about chemsex and recovery is that guys, you know, bottom out with methamphetamine, which is a terrible drug. And so they get into recovery from that. But methamphetamine has become so attached to their sex life basically disappears. And these are the guys that first came into my practice with sexual dysfunctions. Like, I don't know why I can't get aroused at all. I'm not even attracted to anybody anymore because I'm sober, and all that without being really, really high on the drugs, their sexual arousal was gone. And so my work as a therapist in the recovery part of chemsex is really to help people deal with not only that inner stuff, because all the shame and all the internalized homophobia and all those issues. And by the way, I'm working a lot with straight guys now, equally amounts of shame, just over different things, right? But same behavior, same thoughts, no difference at all. But as a sex therapist, what I do is try to help people re-engage some sexual behavior in a healthy way. And this is the problem with chemsex. And it's one that really is not yet understood in the professional community, at least here in the States. There has to be two recovery strategies with chemsex, right? If you have to take care of the drugs and you take care of the sex. And the drug at that point has to be an abstinence model. There's harm reduction, and that ship sailed years ago, usually, for these guys. And so we have to stop. We just have to stop all the drugs. And a lot of times that's a fight, because we'll say, well, I'm an amphetamine addict. I don't even like the feeling of being drunk. Why can't I have alcohol? Why can't I have a beer with my friends at the bar and then and stay away from everything else? Well, the reason in my mind, what I tell them, is that alcohol disinhibits. And I've had a lot of clients who would have that bar with drink with their friends, and suddenly they're thinking about where can I get high again? Because it just introduces that that thought pattern. But the problem with meth and chemsex in general is that when they try to, in sobriety, try to re-engage in sex, and oftentimes for months, the arousal is just gone. But when it does come back, that's often a relapse point because people really don't know how to handle the sexual feelings. So my point here is that we need two recovery strategies. One is abstinent, but we don't want to be abstinent from sex. So we don't want to be abstinent, obviously, from sex, right? So we have to figure out how to invite sex back into our lives. And for many guys, many of the gay guys I worked with, that's like a second coming out. They're dealing with all this stuff that had never been dealt with without drugs before. Most people started out their sexual experimentation back in adolescence by getting drunk and high all the time. So dealing with sex sober, I think probably most of us can identify with that. It's a whole different experience. And all those fears and body issues and self-doubt and all that performance stuff, all that stuff comes right to the fore. And that's kind of what we have to start dealing with. But I found that the sex addiction recovery rooms are really helpful because they have tools about dealing with fantasy and tailoring and individualizing. So these are all really trigger issues. The other thing I wanted to mention about meth that makes it a particularly dangerous drug, I think, is that it does some destructive things that other drugs don't do. When it's working up there in the brain, it will flush all the dopamine out of the system. And when we don't have dopamine in our system, a couple of things happen. We get really, really depressed. We get really impulsive. We have no impulse control. We get really hopeless. And this, in my opinion, is what makes methamphetamine recovery so complicated, because the brain of a meth addict is in that state for a good 3 or 4 months in early recovery. And what that means is that they're struggling with probably the most intense cravings of any substance on earth on a daily basis, on a minute by minute basis. Sometimes they're not feeling any better. They're still feeling really depressed. They're still feeling really hopeless. And their frontal cortex, which is the impulse control in the adult in the room, is offline. So it's like all go, go, go messages with no breaks. And I think that explains, in my opinion, the relapse rate of meth users, which, by the way, evens out after some months in recovery. Meth is no different than alcohol in terms of recovery rates. But if people can survive that early phase, that's the key. And so that's the struggle that a lot of these guys have. By the way, that depression thing, meth runs are usually 4 or 5 days, and people who get so preoccupied, they'll forget to eat, they'll forget to drink, they'll have kidney issues because they don't drink water. They certainly don't take their HIV meds and about half the people that engage in chemsex will become HIV positive. And so it's a big, complicated problem. But you can see that when they start maybe partying on Thursday, they party hard on Friday and Saturday and start putting in the brakes on Sunday. And Monday, they may try to crawl back into their lives somehow. But Tuesdays in the slang world is known as Suicide Tuesdays. And it's known as Suicide Tuesdays because the brain is just, they're in that suicidal mode where they just can't recover from it. And so they have to kind of get through that as well. So they're really fighting a lot of really extreme mood swings and impulse control issues and so on. The other thing that happens with meth, and it happens with a lot of addiction, where the brain tries to adapt to all this dopamine coming at it, And the brain will start to eliminate some of the dopamine receptors, so there's not as much dopamine sloshing around, which is something called dopamine downregulation. But and that recovers, right? The brain will regenerate those once we kind of change, once we get into recovery. And there may be a little lag. But with meth, you get that, but you get also the fact that meth is neurotoxic, which means when this meth molecule blocks that dopamine receptor for 8 or 9 or 10 hours, which is why the meth high is so long, when it rolls away, that receptor is basically dead. And so you're killing off your dopamine receptors even faster. So that contributes to depression and so on. We know that, by the way, as I said, the good news is that those grow, they regenerate, they grow back. With meth users, we know from good research out of our federal government that it takes up to 24 months for those to get back. So it's 24 months, and probably the first 12 of that is much like having really bad ADHD. I've had guys who couldn't read a book. I would have clients ask them to go to a meeting, and you know, the 12 steps and 12 traditions are on the wall. It's all like gibberish. They can't put two words together because their brain is just kind of not functioning properly. So that's chemsex, really. Can people recover? Yes. You know, I did a documentary called Crystal City about 8 guys in meth recovery in New York City, which won a lot of awards, actually. But I will say, caution, because there's a guy that is using in the video. So there's a triggering element to it. But one of the guys in there was in this state of real depression and what we call anhedonia, this guy, inability to experience pleasure in the beginning of his recovery. And on film, he was saying, well, you know, I can't get sober from meth. And I think that anybody that says they're sober from meth is just lying because it's impossible. And he said, and if they say they're sober from meth, they obviously didn't know how to use meth in the first place. So the idea of recovery just didn't make sense to him. So recovery is a long process. It's a fragile process, like it is for all of us. But I think looking back, I guess I found such joy in connecting with people that sounded like me and felt like me and that I could identify with. That's what I remember these many years later, is the joy of that connection. I know I struggled some, but I don't think I struggle as much as I see a lot of these chemsex guys struggling. So that led basically to my work. By the way, I'll mention one other recovery thing. I don't want to talk too long. I've had 2 major relationships in my life. I'm married now to a man. I've been about 15 years. My first partner was also in recovery, and he passed away out of HIV complications in 2004. Now that's well after people should be dying of HIV stuff. But so my point here is to say that it still happens, and he had medication issues. And so that was a real change in my life. When I was 50 years old, I was widowed, basically. And I poured my energy into writing down what I'd learned from working with these chemsec clients. And that was really the birth of my book, Lust, Men, and Meth, which no one would publish because I was an unknown author writing about gay men and addiction. Like, that's a winner combination. Nobody would touch that with a 10-foot pole. So I self-published. And I am pleased to say the book is still going strong around the world. I get emails from people in obscure places saying it's really helped. And I think what the core of that book is, first of all, we're talking about it. It's really hard to find good information about chemsex. But the second thing is I really went into some detail about some of the brain science that goes on. And I did that intentionally because so many chemsex users, so many addicts, I think in general, just have, they come to the table with these beliefs, these negative core beliefs of I'm damaged goods, I'm unworthy, I'm unlovable. You know, if you really knew what was going on in here, you would run so far the other way. All that stuff, right? That addicts, gay, straight, male, female, have. But with meth, it all got focused on their fact that I'm a meth addict, I am damaged goods. And I wanted to point out that a lot of the symptoms of meth recovery are because of the brain and what meth does to the brain, and they can be changed. And so it really kind of destigmatized the process in my mind, and I wanted to really create less shame for folks. So fast forward, the book has been translated to German. As Charlie said, I'll be in Berlin, Munich, and Vienna for me in May to a book signing thing. I consult in Norway and Amsterdam. I'm all over the place. Europe is where it's at right now with ChemSex. I really need to be in Europe. All the research is happening there. I'm part of the formation of a ChemSex Center of Excellence in Barcelona. So, I mean, that's where the heart of this work is right now. But fortunately, we have Zoom and we have airplanes and all kinds of other things, so we can all stay connected. But my point here is that there's really good work going on with ChemSex. There's huge awareness about it, and we know what to do. We know how to treat it. We're getting better at treating it. There are some medications now that help with the cravings. And so I feel progress in that regard. And then to just close up with me, I can't imagine how I'm alive. I can't imagine why I was here, except I go back to that post-traumatic growth thing where I was given a second life, basically a gift after cancer. And there's no cure for HIV, but it's controlled with me. And so purpose and service, that's what I live for, honestly. And so I'm always designing programs, creating things, and working on my recovery. I do a lot of service work in this regard. And I just, I've never lost my gratitude, and I'm grateful for that as well. And the connection, I need the connection still. I go to meetings. I've never forgotten I'm an addict. I've had to change meetings a little bit because I now have so many clients in the town where I live, which is a relatively small town. I can't go anywhere without seeing former clients. And that includes my AA meetings. And finally got so uncomfortable. I just couldn't really share, especially when my partner was dying. So I found other meetings, and I've been more creative, but so I've had to shift some of my home groups, which I was made me sad, but it was necessary, and I'm still very actively involved. So I think with that, I will stop and say, again, I'm so grateful to be here and to be able to share a little bit of the message and spread the ChemSex message, and thank you all. Appreciate it.